And by constructing those instructions, you could draw things like squares and rectangles and triangles, and you know, and you got your algorithms more structured, more elaborate. You drew roses with different colors, and so that was my very first experience with computers and also programming.
That's Banuras Tanaka, architect and co-founder at Theranos. I'm Julian Duque, your host for the Salesforce Developer Podcast, and here in the podcast, we share stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we are going to talk with Banu about GPT for developers, but before, we will start, just as we let off, and we often do, with his early years.
I was very lucky. My parents, we were, you know, kind of middle class, and they devoted themselves to send me to a private school. And this was back in 1980, so I'm a little older. And we had a computer lab at this school. So when I was in first grade, so it's 1981, we had IBM PCs and they had just come out. And there was a program called Logo.
Logo, yes, I remember Logo.
With the turtle.
Yeah. Right?
There was a triangle and it was a turtle.
Yeah.
You know, RGB, four color, magenta, nice. You know, blue, whatever. And you gave it instructions, right? Forward 4 pixels, right turn 90 degrees, forward 8 pixels. And by constructing those instructions, you could draw things like squares and rectangles and triangles, and you know, and you got your algorithms more structured, more elaborate. You drew roses with different colors. And so that was my very first experience with computers and also programming. I mean, we just, you know, back in those days, what were computers, right? There wasn't a lot of things to do on them. So we started with, you know, light programming.
But you went directly to programming. That's very, very lucky. My first experience, I remember using a DOS program called Banner to create like banners or text, 3D. I mean, imagine 3D text just in DOS.
Yeah.
And using those printers, like the
dot matrix
printers to print those banners. Yeah, and I used those banners to create like different messages in my room. It was nice, but I never had the opportunity, like as a kid, to like interact with a programming language or a programming environment like Logo. Mm-hmm. I knew about Logo way, way after.
Mm.
Cool. So you started very, very young. What happened next? So how was your evolution with computers or programming languages after that?
I think, I've always been fascinated with coding. I think I was born that way. The next memory that I have was sixth grade, going to see a movie called War Games.
War Games.
And and my buddy got home that night. It was a sleepover. And we're like, let's spend all night. We're going to stay up all night and we're going to build War Games in BASIC.
Wow.
Because at that point, we were playing around with BASIC. Yeah, are you familiar with?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. With line numbers and, you know, we think about.
Yeah, go to 10.
Things that we no longer have to deal with, right? We had a language that you had line numbers. And what happens when you have to insert code between line 5 and 6?
Mm-hmm.
You have to now renumber your code, right? And if you're using go twos, you're now doubly in trouble.
So, oh, yeah, of course.
So I started writing BASIC and then, but, you know, it was kind of just for fun. I remember we stayed up all night and we were able in ASCII graphics to print out the map of the world, because that was, you know, if you remember War Games, mm-hmm. Whopper ran, you know, the nuclear war simulation, which had a map of the world.
Yes.
So we started there. You know, we used ASCII text and blocks and colors, and that's all we got. We had to go to sleep probably at 6 a.m.
Wow, that's amazing. And after that, you continue.
Yeah, you know, luckily my school had a good, you know, now we're, you know, fast forward mid 80s. We had a computer lab with the IBM 370s, I think, those terminals. And mm-hmm. that's where I learned C. I think that was the first formal language. We also learned Pascal.
Oh, Pascal, with Turbo Pascal.
Borland
Turbo Pascal, the blue screen.
Yeah.
That was my first, well, I dabbled with C as well, but I didn't win, like, after the typical Hello World.
But with Pascal was my first experience. And a friend came to my house when I was 13 with a bunch of diskettes. So let me install this in your computer. He showed me how to write like a function, declare variables, do like basic stuff. And I was not paying too much attention to it. My dad, he was like in his late 50s and he was getting sick. He passed away like some years after that. But he used to program with like PL1 and those like old school technologies. And he saw me like playing with Pascal and he asked me, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm playing with a programming language." He sat down with me and asked me, "Okay, teach me, what are you doing?" So I went ahead and explained him like the very basics that I learned from my friend. I went out. My dad stayed in the computer playing with Pascal. When I came back that night, he was still there. And he told me, "Come, sit with me." And he built, because he was also a mathematician, he built a program with a model to solve differential equations, like second degree differential equations. And I was like, wow. I mean, this guy, my dad, he was like sick and he hasn't been programming for a while. And just with one day, with the logics he learned before, he was able to build something that worked. For me, that was my, this is powerful. I have to learn how to do this. So that was my, like my first real interaction. It was amazing.
That's beautiful on so many ways, right?
Yeah.
And it's rare. I haven't met a lot of second generation coders. So it's pretty cool that your father was a coder.
Yeah. He used to tell me stories about like mainframes, like computers as big as a living room, and how he used to also program them with like perforated cards and that stuff.
The card readers.
For me, I kind of, you know, that concept for me is still very, very far away.
Right. But we're doing it too, right? We talked about basic and line numbers.
Yes.
Yeah, people listening are like, what are they talking about? Line numbers?
Yeah, I think we might say we are very lucky to be able to be exposed to these at a young age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When that turn into your profession?
Professional, I'd say right out of, after high school, I started to play with Microsoft Access.
Access,
yeah. I found Access, so this is like 1994 now. Mm-hmm. I was at university and I started playing with Microsoft Access and specifically with this new technology called Internet Information Server, IIS.
Yeah, yes.
1.0. Mm-hmm. You had these template files, you had these data files. And so I was fascinated with, I can now build a database and I can expose it on this thing called the web and it's real time. And I can update the database here, but anyone in the world can see my updates. Hmm. You know, today that's like no brainer.
Yeah,
that's back in those days, right? We had disks and, you know, the closest we had to the internet back then was FidoNet, right? Which was this distributed dial-up network. Mm-hmm. Like back in the mid-80s, that was one of the things we played with, which were bulletin board systems. Mm-hmm. And so you had this pretty intricate dial-up network that was global. You had these nodes that called each other every day and downloaded emails and messages. And you basically could get a message around the world in 2 days with FidoNet. And so some of that capability was already there, but the idea that we could, you know, use MS Access and like put data out on the web was just super cool. So I can't remember exactly how I got the job, but a local shipping company needed an update on their software. And so I just built them a shipment manager. In fact, that's what it was called, shipment manager. Which is the worst.
Super creative.
I know, just so creative in Microsoft Access. And you know, we did things like exposing tracking numbers to their customers on the web. And, you know, this is pretty advanced, right? FedEx didn't even have any concept of this yet. Wow. So it was fun. So that was the first professional work that I did.
And did you ever do anything besides working with computers, or this was your thing since the beginning?
I was an avid surfer also.
Surfer.
Oh. In fact, my dad, like I remember when I was 17, he lectured me on, you're going to college and you're not going to be a pro surfer.
Oh.
So I was really into surfing at the same time.
Oh, do you still surf?
I do occasionally. You know, as you get older and more out of shape, it's less enjoyable. And I'm very picky now on the days that I go out.
Yeah. I might say I have a little bit of tassalophobia. So I'm afraid of the deep sea.
The creatures.
I don't know.
Well, I always tell people I have the same, but when you surf, you're on the top, right? So you don't see it really.
Okay.
Yeah. But when I go diving, it freaks me out a little bit.
Oh, yeah. It'll freak me out a lot for sure. How was that introduction to Salesforce for you?
Yeah, it was a nonprofit. So I was a customer first. I was hired as a technical executive to replace Razor's Edge with Salesforce. And this was back in 2010-ish. So it was back in the day when nonprofit starter pack existed. It wasn't the success pack yet. And me and my team implemented Salesforce. It was very painful. I learned a lot through the process. And mostly because I came as a developer, right? By that point, I was a full stack dev. And so I remember my first experience with Salesforce was, I can't write code in production. You know, like I just wanted to try the thing out, right? I was like, I want to write Apex. And I'm like, wait, I can't do it in prod. That's interesting. I have to do this sandbox thing, you know? So I really had to learn the ropes of Salesforce's environment, you know, which is, you know, for those of us in the ecosystem that have been working with the platform, I always tell folks, like, our knowledge of the limitations or the guardrails, the governor limits, right? How Salesforce works is our value.
And this was how long ago? What year did you start with Salesforce?
It was about 2010.
2010?
Yeah.
This was a long time ago.
It was a while ago, yeah. So, you know, everything was much smaller, right? We didn't have Marketing Cloud, no Slack, you know, no Quip, you know. So I feel like I was in the, and, you know, people would probably argue who were here a decade before me when they first started, but I feel like it was the first wave. It still felt small. And then entering into like the mid 2015s, there was another, through all those acquisitions, I feel like Salesforce did another boom. And, you know, it's now huge, right? In my opinion, it's, you know, we were joking earlier that, you know, no one knows the whole system.
No, it's impossible. it's massive. And have you done like full-time mostly Salesforce, or there have been like some other technologies that you have been
In the last 13 years, you know, I think we dabbled with a bit of Drupal and, you know, the normal stack that you find in nonprofits that connect to Salesforce, but I would never focus myself there. I've been, you know, I'm a full supporter of putting everything on platform. Like, nice. That's why you pay a lot for it.
Yep.
You know, use it.
Totally. That's great. So let's talk about what we came to talk about, which is AI and this new boom, the generative AIs, GPT, all of this revolution we are living right now. How you started with AI? How was that first experience for you?
Mm-hmm. All my life, I wanted to learn Lisp, which I never
Lisp.
Did. So I think in the back of my mind or somewhere inside of me, I've always wanted to play with this. You know, the first time that I saw the machine interacting like a human was with Eliza. You know, there was a, I don't know what you would call it. It was a text-based thing called Eliza that was, I guess, built in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it made its way to PC. I think it was ported to BASIC. And we had a copy of it. And we would play with it and it would start up and it says, you know, I think she would say, elucidate your thoughts. That was her opening prompt to you, which I think was interesting is Eliza prompted you versus all our other you know, the modern interactions, we prompt the machine. Mm-hmm. But I've thought about that a lot lately. Like, what if they start prompting me? Like my Google device, when I go home, it recognizes me, right? So it actually prompts me. When I walk into the kitchen and it hasn't seen me yet for that day, it will say, good morning, Banu. So, you know, maybe it is prompting. But Eliza was the first time, and this was back in the 80s, you know, so it was very rudimentary. And I can't remember, you know, how accurate it was, but it was amusing, right? Mm-hmm. It was the first time we thought, okay, it's talking to us. And in those days, we were having some really low quality audio, right? If you remember, yep. There was like some voice or text to voice, but it was pretty horrible.
Yep.
So they're starting to become a little more human, I guess, or more, more human.
Yeah, more humanized.
Mm-hmm.
It is right now when I see where this technology is going, I get really fast into the uncanny valley, because these videos or images that are generated by the AI or the text-to-speech, now it starts getting difficult to recognize if it is like generated by an AI or if it is real. So we are getting into a very interesting territory.
I mean,
now.
The whole term AI, I mean, I do appreciate that at least in certain circles, we're calling it GPT or LLMs. Mm-hmm. I think AI is such a general term. It has the word intelligence in it. And I don't know if we're there yet. I think it has modeled human mm-hmm. language, right? I think it's even good with foreign languages also, yeah. Not just English, right? It has indexed a lot of other languages.
I have interacted in Spanish with it and the results are amazing. Really? And I can even prompted to use certain specific dialects of Spanish because it's very different. The Spanish that we speak in Colombia is different than the Spanish that folks in Argentina speak.
Yeah.
And if I prompt ChatGPT, okay, tell me something in Colombian Spanish, it does a pretty good job, which is incredible.
I wonder if it could go back in time too, right? So, you know, some of the common prompting patterns, like as a thing, right? As an Argentinian, back in 1750,
wow.
Write this, you know, I've never thought of this, yeah, but it'd be interesting to
language
find out.
Evolves as
it
well.
It does, right?
That's an interesting experiment to do.
Yeah.
Do you use GPT in your day-to-day job, or do you do it just like for fun?
I do it both. You know, I'm currently very fascinated by it. I think the fun parts of it is testing it. You know, I think currently what people do a lot of, they're like, oh, what if, you know, does the AI do this? And it's like, just try it, right? Last night we were having a debate about something. And so I just, you know, we fired up ChatGPT, we fired up Anthropic, and then we fired up Bard, and we just compared, you know, what the results were. And we found that GPT was very conservative. You know, it kind of took offense to what we were asking. And then Anthropic was just straight up. It just answered the question. And then Bard was just a little confusing, right? Well, not Bard. I'm sorry. It's Google search with AI or whatever that is. So, you know, I think the fun part is playing. For me, also, the fun part is consuming a lot of YouTubes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a guy called 2-Minute Papers. I love 2-Minute Papers because what he does is he condenses academic papers and he does it not in only 2 minutes. It's a catchy name. He's normally 6 to 8 minutes, but
it still is short.
It's still short. It's still short, right? And he consumes it for us, right? He's a PhD and he brings it down in layman's terms and he has great graphics. So I really point to 2-Minute Papers as a YouTube channel that spurred my interest in machine learning and what was coming out. Because all of this, what we see today, started, you know, a decade ago, right? Mm-hmm. And has been evolving. Like the introduction of GPT itself and the development of these large language models really allows us to get where we are today. And those are, let's say, inventions. I mean, neural networks have been around for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember when I was a teenager, at a science fair, someone did a a project on neural networks. You know, that's 1990. Mm-hmm. And that's underpinning our language models. So consuming YouTubes, like that's my form of entertainment. And it tends to be all along AI and learning about what's new. Because literally every day there's something new, right? There's a new development, new news.
Yeah. I have seen a lot of sentiment of FOMO, like fear of missing out from people. They want to get into these LLMs, AI, machine learning, but they get this kind of challenge because you think that you might need to know a lot of math and science and it's going to be difficult and you don't even try to get into that domain and you don't do anything. But to start experimenting with these technologies like GPT, you don't need to understand how they work. If you want to maybe, of course, like do like a research or build one or implement one, sure. But to use it, you don't have to get into that.
Yeah.
What's the skill that, like the minimum skill that we need to have to start using technologies like GPT?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I can approach that from two directions. One, my own experience of being able to engineer prompts and get it to do what I want it to do. That's based on being in technology for 30 years, right? And coding for, I guess, if I do the math, 42 years. Mm-hmm. I've been writing code. I've been making machines do stuff, right? Yeah. So I have an innate way of formulating, I want you to do this, but I'm, you know, with specific words, specific phrasing. So I think one of the things that folks should learn is how to engineer prompts. Because if you are more of a junior and new to this work, it's not immediately clear how to make the machine do what you want it to do. Because you actually don't know how to think through the steps. You still have to make the machine go through steps, or let's just say GPT, to produce something. You can't just give it a very generic thing and have it get it right. And there's a lot of tuning, right? There's a lot of looping. Yeah. So I think for beginners, for people who are interested in it, you know, using specific prompts, you know, going to YouTube, getting research. There's a lot of classes now online that will teach you how to do prompt engineering. The same way that we had to learn how to search with Google.
Yep.
Yeah. We had to, we phrase things differently with Google. It's not even natural how we've, you know, over the last 20 plus years, you know, to get results. So I think over time, it's just going to become second nature. And I really think the current version of GPT is kind of search on steroids, right? It's search plus. It gives you results of things. So like say you're looking for a, you know, recipe, you're, you know, you don't have to search for a specific recipe like on Google. You can give it, you can give GPT a list of ingredients and it can kind of combine that all together and make something for you. Mm-hmm. Or if you did the reverse, you're like, okay, I want to make shepherd's pie. You would, you know, say something like, you know, as a James Beard award-winning chef, make me the best shepherd's pie, give me the ingredients, you know, list out the tools that I need, and then give me instruction with precise timing and instruction on how to make this dish.
Wow. One thing that I have seen that it's very interesting is folks that are using GPT for meal planning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, give me, I mean, I need to hit this amount of calories a day, like give me a week meal planning and like give me recipes, and they're like even losing weight with these technologies. I the amount of use cases that I have seen is incredible to me.
Yeah, that actually makes me think I should ask it now. I need to lose some weight. Yeah, me create me a weekly meal plan with these types of food, you know, that could be really interesting.
Yeah. So I'm using it at work, of course, for my hobbies, but I think I still need to use it more for some other use cases.
Yeah.
Do you think, well, we were talking about how to search in Google for me, searching in Google is a basic skill now.
Yeah.
If you are working with computers, like most of the people do, you have a good advantage if you know how to search. Do you think this, like GPT or prompting, because obviously other technologies are available and they are going to be available, but prompting is becoming or will become a basic skill?
For now, I think it is becoming a basic skill. And I say for now because in my limited experience, I feel like we're at the start of something different in computing. Mm-hmm. And we don't know where that's going to go yet. I mean, I'm sure there's many smart people who have a vision of that. But for me, I don't know what that's going to look like. I do see how it's moving towards, if you watch Star Trek, for instance, and you mm-hmm. watch how engineering interacts with the machine, right, with the Enterprise.
Yeah.
It's like status check, and then it talks back, right? Versus how we do it, which is we go and look at governor limits, and we, maybe type a little bit of Apex to see where we're at, or there's a dashboard, or, mm-hmm. It's very clunky how we interact. So I envision that in the future, natural language will play a role, but maybe it's just going to be how we speak,
And this will change the way how we interact with computers, like user interface. I think this is going to be a new area of study for UX engineers, for example.
Yep.
How can they start like building interfaces or building experiences that rely on AI or GPT or these technologies to, improve how to interact with a computer?
Yeah.
Like, it's very science fiction for me. Like these movies where people are just waving hands and controlling computers and just talking and they do what you say. It's becoming like a reality super fast. I think we are in the middle of a paradigm shift.
Oh, absolutely. I accidentally came upon smart devices at home over the past years.
Mm-hmm.
So my entire house has smart devices in every room and all the lights are controlled by those devices. Our doors are controlled by the devices. So when you go into a room, the actual light switches don't work. and my wife initially pushed back, but what it has taught us is how do you prompt a machine, because at first it feels weird.
Yeah.
You feel like you're commanding, but that's how it works, right? I walk into a room and I say, turn on lights, or I can from another room say, turn off all the lights in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So there's a way that I don't have to physically push. I have to think and say it. Mm-hmm. And I could be in any room, and think, oh, I left the front door unlocked, lock the front door. So it gives you this flexibility that breaks down the physical boundaries. And the reason we did it initially was because we were renting. And if anyone who has rented, your lighting is always horrible.
Yeah.
So we replaced, we would basically just have lamps and things, but then you have the problem of the switches.
Mm-hmm.
So we then had these Philips Hue switches all over, but then eventually we just went with smart devices.
Nice. I love it. As a telecommunications engineer, I remember when I was back in college, they were imagining the future. So these telecommunications companies, we are going to live in a connected future with the smart devices. And they draw a very beautiful picture of, and it's very accurate what we are experiencing right now. I have smart devices at home. I love that technology. But at the same time, I think about the privacy and security concerns behind that. Because obviously, somebody is smarter than like the builders of those technologies, or more smarter than me, can break into the security of those devices. We have cameras to monitor our pets who might be watching us. We don't know. So it's fascinating that we have these advances, but also make us be more aware about like the potential security and privacy concerns that are behind.
Yeah.
For you, what are those concerns around technologies like GPT. Do you feel like positive that the future is going to be amazing, or are you a little bit scared like some people with this?
I once had a friend who described me as like, I think he would call it frolicking in the daisies. It's my personality to not worry about certain things, which I think is a character flaw of mine. I hear all the points and I think they're all valid. I think at a macro level, I get concerned, right? What is the data being used for? Are we just being monetized? You know, the whole model of freemium, I think we've realized that society doesn't work because mm-hmm. the humans become the product. But beyond that, I am mostly just excited to see where we're going to go next.
Yes. I've heard some other podcasts and interviews. People try to like predict what's coming next. Like, how do you imagine GPT or these technologies are going to be in the next year or 5 years? Because in just a couple of months, we have seen like an exponential growth and usage.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For you, how is the immediate future for this, like next year?
Yeah. I hope in a year, we get access to models that are trained specifically on the platform, right? Salesforce platform. Mm-hmm. Because currently we're using models that have been shared with other languages. So there are at times a lot of cross, you know, errors basically, right? It Apex looks like Java. So sometimes it responds with methods that we don't have that only exist in Java. Mm-hmm. So, and I think something that is trained directly on all of our Apex and all of our config is going to be really smart. I mean, think about the reinforcement learning of every time we compile, it's saying whether we were right or wrong. Mm-hmm. There's a new as in the last week, released publicly. It's an open AI tool called Code Interpreter.
Oh, yes.
And what that does is it builds Python code to do the thing you want it to do. It will also create a test class. And if the tests fail, it will continue to adjust the code until the tests pass automatically, right? So now we're seeing AI fold on itself. I think in the next year, we're going to see a lot more of that. AI's, you know, running in loops on itself, multiple AIs working together to verify. And really on the Salesforce side, specifically to Salesforce developers, all we're missing is that thing to compile.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe this is our interim product. My assumption is Salesforce is going to do this. So, you know, that's why I'm not rushing out to go build this tool. I assume Salesforce will build it because it's kind of a no-brainer.
That's what we are aiming with Einstein GPT and the whole like other like service GPT, cloud GPT, and not only on the user side of things, because for users are going to be, you know, a very, very great step over what we are doing today, but also for developers. And there will be some developer tooling that are coming that it definitely will improve that workflow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dreaming about this like code generation tools that are org aware. So they know about your org, your metadata, mm-hmm. the other classes. So they can easily recommend you how to like call other things that you already have on your org.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That they learn, train the model with your data. That yeah. I think that's going to be very, very powerful.
For it to be metadata aware.
Yes. Right?
So you
exactly.
can speak in generic terms about your account object and it knows what fields you have, what the types are, you know, even a validation rules. Mm-hmm. Then you can start to think, well, you know, you could probably write test harnesses that are AI based, AI agents mm-hmm. that will continuously monitor and run things against your org and develop new ways mm-hmm. of breaking it because it can just keep on running.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you're writing a Lightning Web Component, it will be aware about like Apex classes
it,
that already
it can have. Do that. GitHub Copilot, yep. right? If you have multiple, and I've done this. So, you know, my normal workflow is if I'm starting something brand new, I'll use ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. I think it's good at just kind of fleshing out boilerplate and just creating a class file.
Yeah.
Then I will put it into GitHub Copilot. Because that's in VS Code.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm working in the org, right? Yeah. So I can push that into the org. Then Copilot will be aware of code if the window is open. So in this scenario, I will create the Apex class and keep that open. Then I will create a shell of an LWC, and then I will start commenting out in lines what I want it to do. So specifically in the JavaScript controller of the LWC, I can say invoke this Apex method, and then it will build the header. That it's an include, right?
Yeah, it will import.
Yeah, the import, the decorator. So it will import that Apex class. It knows about it because it's open and I've tested this and it has it correctly. Now, the part that didn't work was passing variables back and forth.
Binding, yes.
Yeah, it broke down there. You know, so I was slightly frustrated. I think the end result, so I tried to build a very simple LWC using just purely GPT technology. Mm-hmm. And I would say I got 50% of the way there without doing anything. And it compiled, but it didn't work. Nothing happened.
Well,
so,
but it's still getting the 50% is, I mean.
You know, it saved me 20 minutes of work. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. You know, I think that's the thing that I want people to, you know, experience, right? I often tell folks, like, every day it gives me a moment of like, whoa, that was cool.
Yeah, I do a lot of live coding on our YouTube channel, and most of that is using JavaScript. And Copilot is very smart with JavaScript, mm-hmm. so I sometimes don't worry about it, and I just let it autocomplete, and it does a really great job. Mm-hmm. So I can't wait until we have that highly trained in Apex and LWC and also Flow GPT that is also coming.
Yeah.
It will be a good near future for sure.
Yeah. What will be interesting is, will it become heavier? And I just thought about this when you mentioned Flow. So, you know, as a coding developer, I can write a trigger or some update really fast. And if I go to Flow, it feels cumbersome. Mm-hmm. I have to point and click, you know, I have to do all those things. And I wonder at a certain point, would prompt engineering, like say in Flow, feel heavier than doing the Flow? Because you're like step-by-step instructing the machine, you know, fetch records, now loop on that. Or whether Flow GPT would be so higher level that you could instruct it and it would generate code just like how it works today.
I think that's...
It'll generate metadata. Yes. Yeah. That's another thing to test. I think it was Copilot. One of the, maybe it was GPT, can generate metadata. Like I had it build me an object in metadata and it did it. And so that was another realm of, you know, when you're like creating a brand new org and you have to build all these objects, mm-hmm. you know, it's cumbersome to point and click.
Yes.
But if you could just train it with natural language and just elaborate on it. In fact, you could probably even just take the requirements document and throw it in there. Now that's interesting, right?
Give me an object with these fields, these relationships, and I have the metadata.
So you train your business analyst to write requirements that are clear enough that you could put back into the AI, which will then just build the thing. I love that because it reinforces documentation. The one cool side effect of Copilot being the way it is that I prompt it with comments. Mm-hmm. So now my code has a ton of comments. Yeah. And it also does the inverse, right? You can highlight code and say, write my comment. Mm-hmm. But I actually think the natural way to do it is you're writing your comments because those are your instructions to tell mm-hmm. GPT or Copilot to do, you know, its next steps.
And then you iterate and fix, of course.
Yeah.
Beautiful. This is fascinating. And for me, I'm excited about what we can do today. So I can't imagine what we can do mm-hmm. tomorrow with this. This has been one of the recent technologies that has me hyped. Like really, hyped.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I will spend probably 8 to 10 hours consuming content about this world. And to your point earlier, right. I'm not a mathematician. I don't know lists. I don't know any of the underpinning technologies. Mm-hmm. But to me, that's similar of all of us in the ecosystem, right? I've never seen the code of Salesforce. I heard that you can actually run it on a laptop, which I think is fascinating. Mm-hmm. But I don't know anything about it, you know. I don't know anything about its architecture underlying from what we're exposed to. So it's very similar, right? It's the age of platforms, right? Us in the knowledge, I guess, the knowledge workforce, we've already been trained in a way. I think some of the questions that we get from people about AI is like, well, you know, things are going to be different and junior people will no longer have jobs. But the reality is we're already doing it. And what Salesforce has done is opened up technology work to a whole separate set of people, mm-hmm. right? Folks who don't have traditional computer science degrees are building gigantic solutions on a tech platform that's based in technology. Mm-hmm. So the exciting thing is what's next, right? Maybe English majors are going to take over technology next because they're just good with words, better than computer science exactly. people. I don't know.
Those have the right skills right? now.
But I guess, you know, the story of that is we've already been through a shift like this. We don't, again, the daisies, but we don't have to be that worried, I think. We don't know what's next.
Yeah, folks ask me about the same thing. Aren't you worried? This is going to take over our jobs. And it is not the AI that is taking over our jobs. It's the people that know how to use the AI that are going to take over our jobs. Mm-hmm. So our task is to learn these AI technologies, how to work with them, and use it.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully, if you're heading this direction, you enjoy the work, right? I think we're lucky we plugged a passion into a way to have a job or to make a living. Mm-hmm. And I hope that for everyone, right, to find their passion. And if you can stick with it and hopefully you can make a living from it, you'll be great at it.
Yeah. Totally, totally true. Speaking of passion, to change topics a little bit, besides surfing, what are your other hobbies? What do you like to do? What's that thing that keeps you also alive?
Golf. Golf is actually my current hobby. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. I don't know why. I golfed yesterday, actually, and I'm golfing tomorrow. I travel with my clubs, and it's just the greatest thing. You know, for me, you can do it for a very long time, right? It's low impact generally. My father's 77. We golf, you know, once a week together. He sometimes still beats me, you know, it's great. And you never master it, right? It's kind of like technology.
Yeah.
Because technology is always changing, so we never master it. It's the same techniques, the same patterns, but you'll never master it because there's so many variables that are at play.
Beautiful. I will never guess, like coming from like this extreme activity, which is surf, to this peaceful one, which is golf. Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Banu, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast. And I hope all the folks that are listening to us start like getting into this AI journey as well.
Thank you, Julian. It's been great.
Of course.
And that's all. If you want to learn more about this show, head on to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear all the episodes and read the show notes. Thank you, everybody, and talk to you the next time.